I would like, if we could, please give a warm Valley Group welcome to Sheila M. from Livermore, California.
Thanks, Jim, and hi to the Valley Group. It's my name is Sheila, and I am an alcoholic, regular old alcoholic, and it's awesome to be here tonight. I'm so grateful to be sober one more day. And, gosh, with the tools in the program and the spiritual experience that I've had by working in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to take a drink since May 27, 2005. Actually, I took a drink on May 26, 2005. My sober day was the 27th. So, you know, today I'm really grateful to be living a life that I love, most of it. I mean, it's mostly good. And it's a life I really never did think I could have. I wasn't trying to like Alcoholics Anonymous, and it turns out I love it. I love it more than I ever thought I would. I didn't want to come here. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I certainly didn't want to come and be hugging everybody. When I got sober, we were meeting in person, obviously, but and be told what to do. That was really a big thing on why I didn't want to get sober. I didn't want to be told what to do, and I wasn't done, and was really unruly for a long time. Gosh, there's a few things I need to share as I open it. And, Jim, thanks very much for the introduction. You cracked me up because you asked me all these things on my on the text, and I was like, well, God, what am I even going to talk about? I usually share those things. So we were good sports about it, I think. But, yeah, that's my home group. I am a sponsored woman. I do sponsor other women. I am part of a beautiful sponsorship lineage. And the deal is, you know, when we take people on to sponsor them and work the steps, it's, you know, the big question I ask at the beginning is what was asked of me is, are you willing to give this to someone else? So I'm not, yeah, so I agreed to give it away. And that's one of the conditions of me being sober. I mean, yes, it's fun and it's the highlight of our lives. And we talk about that. You guys read that passage, working with others at the beginning of the meeting. And it is the bright spot in my life. But the catch is I don't stay sober if I don't do those things. So, I should just tell you those things that sometimes I forget if I don't. And I feel nervous tonight. I don't know why, but, I think maybe because Alcoholics Anonymous means so much to me that I get scared sometimes I'm just going to mess it up or not represent it well, but it just means the world to me. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's another reason why, you know, why I repay my debt to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I think about the people that came before me and what if they got their lives together as a result of working the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous and they got all grateful and they went home to be grateful? You know, they didn't. They came back down to the fellowship and they stayed in service and they expressed their gratitude in action. And that's what I was taught to do too. So, we hear a lot about gratitude in the month of November, and it's important for me to remember how much action we need to take around that. I do personally. Sponsorship, yes, I gave it away. I have a home group. That's a Saturday morning breakfast group. We meet at 9 o'clock Saturday mornings. Under normal, we're doing a Zoom right now. We meet in Pleasanton, California. It's a mixed meeting. We have the best French roast around. And we serve donuts and we serve bagels. And I never knew what it really meant to be part of a home group until I got a commitment there and got involved and really got in the middle. We're a three legacy group. We work the steps. We have our, you know, good, strong speakers, and we practice the traditions, and we are involved with general service. Those things are very important for me for my home group, too. And if you don't have a home group that you love, or if you want to try a new one, I would love to share the Zoom information in the chat at the end. It's my favorite place to be all week. So I mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous restored my life. I didn't really know what that was even going to look like, but before I do that, I need to qualify as an alcoholic, and, you know, I'm an alcoholic. Still, sometimes I think I get up and I can think about drinking, too, to this day. You know, it's a 24-hour deal, and if I'm not in a good position, if I'm not going to meetings, if I'm not working a program, I can find myself at 15 years sober thinking things like, maybe that's what I need is, you know, a good bender, you know, I hear somebody talking about something, or somebody just drinking something in a restaurant, I'm an alcoholic, and I will become obsessed with the thought that maybe one day I can drink like normal people, or maybe it'll be different, you know. And those to me are warning signs to, you know, get my butt back in a meeting, or to be calling my sponsor, or just, you know, picking up the tools. We have tools today. And, you know, life's not perfect. Things come up, but what it says in the spiritual experience, what I found to be true, is that my reaction to life is better when I'm using tools. So for a program I didn't want to come to, I sure am having a good time using the tools that I learned here. So anyway, I started drinking in my high chair. It was really cute. I was the firstborn. I got a lot of attention for it. I was a daddy's girl. He was a truck driver. He was gone a lot. But when he was home, we were drinking together. And there's pictures of me in the baby book with my cheeks all red and I'm tipped over and drooling. And, you know, I had my little buzz going on. And that was, I got a lot of attention for that. We bonded a lot drinking. And in my baby books and stuff, one of the first sentence that I had put together, my mom recorded it in my little book, was, I like beer. And I got a lot of attention for it, and so I said it a lot, and I drank it a lot. And, it, you know, 3 years old, I was pouring my dad a perfect beer in his glass with a little perfect head on it, and the leftovers went to me in my Donald Duck beer cup. And that's the way it was. I didn't have to sneak it. I didn't know there was anything wrong with it. I loved it, and I loved my dad, and we had a good time with it. And, if I wanted beer, I asked for it, and I got it. I don't know. Looking back on it, was that alcoholic? Was it not? Was it? What's a 2 and 3 year old normal drinker even look like? But but it was with permission, and there was no sneaking in line. And when I look back at the progression of the disease, it wasn't until probably sixth grade that there was lying and sneaking also involved. And I think at that point, things had started to kind of change with that. You know, and I should add this in, like at 7, I was drinking whiskey and I loved it. I got a lot of attention for that. I didn't flinch. And I mean, the smell of that, the smell of my uncle and his Copenhagen and whiskey, I mean, that was like heaven for me. And anyway, so no big deal. That's just kind of how we lived. I'm the oldest of 4 kids. For some reason, the other kids didn't get everything that I got. I mean, drinks. So I felt special and favorite, like the favorite also. So that was kind of cool. But in sixth grade, there was, I was babysitting. I was babysitting the house next door, the kids at the house next door. And they had just moved in and they had gigantic crates with in their garage of unpacked things. And like any good babysitter, I went through those things and I found hundreds of bottles of alcohol. It was like probably 6x6 crate, and it was just all alcohol bottles. I had never seen anything like it. And so I would babysit for them all the time, and I would always put bottles in the bushes and then go get them later and stuff. And that's when the sneaking and the stealing and the lying and the ulterior motives, I was like, I'll babysit. I mean, I wanted so bad to be their favorite babysitter, and, you know, for obvious reasons. And I had a double life going on, because to them I was such a goody-goody. And as soon as I was away from there, I was, you know, drinking that alcohol and sneaking and lying and telling my mom all kinds of things. And it was in sixth grade when I started was sneaking out in the middle of the night to drink. And injuries and things like that were coming up, and I was, you know, my mom was like, well, what's that about? What happened to you? And, you know, then here comes more lies, so I gotta cover it up, and where we were, and, you know, the trouble and the lies that were coming out of that. But I never really got in serious trouble, so it progressed. And she moved out when I was 14. I was the oldest of 4 kids, and my dad let me do whatever I wanted. So we promptly started having kegger parties, and he would buy the alcohol. I was only 14, but I had to drive to get it after he started getting his buzz on, because being a truck driver, he didn't want to get DUI and stuff. So he was happy to show his ID and do the transaction, and we would always come up with the money, and he'd give us the kegs. And that was like we had a lot of friends, a lot of traffic when we're having kegger parties all the time. And that's just how we lived. My dad said I could miss school, but I couldn't miss work. And, you know, when I was hungover and things like that, he just said, you know, handle your business. handle your business, you can do whatever you want. And I said, okay. So I did. And so I partied hard for a really long time. I started, there was more and more consequences as I got older. Some of the things I didn't like when there was, as a result of being passed out or victimized in certain situations. And we started to learn how to experiment with that and have stuff, you know, maybe control the pass out, mixing like drugs with that too. And I really liked that too, because I felt like I was on top of it, and I didn't feel like I didn't feel the consequences as much because I could control some of that. You know, I drank on my jobs. I was working at Round Table Pizza from the time I was 14 till 16 and a half, and we drank off the keg there. I drank it. I always drank it on the job. I would put it in these Carl's Jr. cups, and we'd put ice in it, and it'd be alcohol. We'd drink it on the sales floor, and we'd drink it on I was big into that. And at 21, we had office parties. My boss would bring in the blender, and we would have Margarita Friday, and we'd just start getting hammered right around 10 o'clock in the morning. It was on the job, so there was all these messages, but it was just okay, you know. And I figured I was probably going to die from, like, some type of alcohol poisoning or drug overdose, because those are the kinds of consequences that I would be having. And, you know, when I found out I was pregnant at 24, I knew that I had to have this kid because I was probably going to die from this lifestyle. You know, I was like, well, God, I better have him because, you know, I might not be around later. But that was, you know, my justification, my reasoning and stuff. And so I have him, and I carry on. And he was a tough little kid. He was always rolling with everything. And a lot of parents kind of grow up and have these kids and they get sober or they go behave themselves or something. And that wasn't me. Yeah. I learned that I could take him anywhere I wanted. I put him on my back. We could go to Rolling Stones concerts. And I partied. I partied the way I wanted to, and I carried this kid around with me. And that was, I guess, cool for a while. But, you know, things started to interfere. The CPS started to get involved a lot. Folks like my own folks would, my mom would come by and check and ask things like, you know, don't you think it's time to sober up? What about your little boy? And things like that. And I wasn't going to listen to it. You know, it was what they talk about in the big book about frothy emotional appeal. Like, nobody over here crying about how much I'm hurting them or how much I'm hurting my kid or whatever is going to make me stop drinking. Like, I was my own woman with my own house and my own, you know what I mean? I'm doing my own thing. I did not want to be told what to do, especially to stop drinking. And so I was always, telling her, like, mind your own business, you know. I wasn't saying it very nice either. And she started calling CPS, and I had all these friends, and they had experience beating CPS, and that didn't set off any flags to me. They would tell me what we have to do to get CPS off my back, and so I was like, okay. And we were just in the nick of time, make it, and nothing would happen. Wouldn't have any consequences again. I get to keep the kid, and they were off my back, and I won, right? And it sounds stupid, but that's kind of like how it was. And that happened a lot. And during one of those visits with the police and everything, I had told them that my mom was crazy and that she was just upset with me because I would no longer want to participate in her abusive lifestyle and things, just all this like crazy whack stuff, right? And what a surprise. It gets the cops to, they leave me alone, and and so she's just crazy, right? She's just calling the cops for no reason. Thank you very much. Does he look like he's missed a meal? No, he hasn't. Have a nice day. Nope, I'm not on probation. You can't search me. You can have a nice day. Get away from me. And so, again, skin of my teeth. And so it's like, I just went too far one night, and the cops came, and it was a horrible, horrible scene. And there was all kinds of health and safety dangers there. There was no electricity in my house. There wasn't food. There wasn't any kind of thing. And I don't even know how I'm raising a kid there. I know I'm busted. I'm way over my head. They take him. My mom comes to the scene. She rescues him. I'm thankful for that, right? And then I go to jail, and she gets a phone call. They went and did their homework, I guess, and then they went in a marked car and picked up my son from her house, saying that she was crazy and they had papers that she was unfit. So he goes off to a foster home, because of my stupid self, and I'm in jail, and I'm just mad at everybody else, and, you know, like, it's, I'm raging mad. I can't take responsibility for anything or my lifestyle. I mean, I was living in a house where I have this beautiful three-year-old, and he wasn't allowed to take a sip of anything in our house without smelling it, because that was my way of keeping him safe in the party zone that we lived, right? And that was, like, me being a good mom, I thought. And so anyway, she gets him taken away from her for that, and she does a heck of a job getting, you know, all the paperwork straight. She gets him back finally. But I didn't understand all that stuff. I wouldn't look at it or take responsibility for it. So I go to rehab, and I didn't want to go to rehab. It was suggested that I go to rehab because I wanted my kid back. And I was like, what are you guys, stupid? I'm not trying to go to rehab. I'm trying to get my kid back. What, you know, get out of my way. And we, like, I didn't understand that I was going to really have to have a lifestyle change. I mean, it was so much like me not seeing the forest for the trees, or being able to take responsibility for my alcoholism or for any of the consequences that were happening. I just thought people were being mean to me, and it wasn't fair. I thought they were trying to ruin my life. And so I'm going to close the door. I have a dog, so I'm going to be in the meeting with them. So nosy. So anyway, I didn't want to go to rehab, and I was talking to this lawyer, and I was going through all these things, and he was like, nope, click, and because I'm trying to get the kid back, click, 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 and then finally this one call, I called him back, and he was like, why should I help you? And I said, because I'm an alcoholic. He's like, okay, that's what's going on. You get yourself a bed, you get yourself a treatment, and I'll help you. And that was the first time I really admitted that out loud, but, you know, I think I knew along the way. I remember being told, I was hearing my mom talk when I was a kid about alcoholics being wired differently, like genetically we're designed differently, and she was saying that, and I remember thinking about that in my teens and in my 20s about my drinking and this alcoholic thing, but I was never ready to look at that. I certainly didn't want to own it. And by looking at certain people in my family, I never wanted to be that. I never wanted to be them, you know, the whole alcoholic stigma. I just couldn't handle that. And so it was huge that day that I said, because I'm an alcoholic. It was like a big relief. And there was still a lot of work to do, and I had a really bad attitude. But what happened was I went to rehab, and I had a bad attitude. I was a brat. I was a super brat, and I had a restraining order against my son, so I wasn't allowed to call or to write or to see him or anything like that. And I was just thought everybody was so mean. And I was just so consumed with being a victim and how everybody had ruined my life, and nothing was my fault, you know. So I'm there, and I have a bad attitude, and I have an affair with a couple of people, and you know, I'm not taking it seriously. I'm getting ready to get kicked out, and that's not fair either. And they told me things like, you know, it's not about you, honey, it's not about you. And I was like, you're lying. What do you mean it's not about me? I hated them when they told me that not everything is about you, Sheila, is what they said. And I was like, you were so full of it. I hate you. I hated them. And so I'm getting ready to get kicked out because I was just off the hook. And I begged to let me stay because I realized that, you know, in 1 week I was kind of leaving, and I didn't have an address, and I didn't have any, you know, I had lost my whole life. I didn't even have anywhere to go if they did let me out. Like, what was I supposed to do? So I begged them for to let me finish, and they did. At 35 days, I graduated, and I went to court, and the judge gave me a deal to live in the house. I mean, not a deal like a deal, but he, like, I got to be on probation, and I got to go live in the recovery home across the street. The same guy owned it. The owner of the rehab owned the recovery home across the street, and so I got to go live there and get a job at the rehab. I ended up driving the bus there, or the van. I would drive everybody down to the meetings and stuff, and kind of, you know, get my life together and stuff like that. And so I did that, and I was able to. The door started to open. I could start to see my son a little bit. And so I did that, and I started to go work a program a little bit. I didn't get sponsored or anything, but I did go to a few women's meetings, and I started to feel good. I started to actually embrace this recovery thing and go with it. you know? And then I started sneaking around with Bobby Jr., who it was his dad owned the place. And I started sneaking around with him and working the night shift with him and stuff like that. And I ended up pregnant there. And, you know, that was really serious stuff. And they ended up kicking me out for it. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, you can't kick me out. And they're like, go to court. So I did. And the judge said, you know, Miss Mulligan, I'm appalled with you. And no, he said, I'm appalled. And I said, I am too, because they had kicked me out. I said, I know, I can't believe it. And he said, Miss, seriously, I was appalled. And he said, no, I'm appalled with you. You've got one kid you can't take care of. You don't even have him back yet. You ruined your life. Dad, and he's like, just reads me the riot act. And now you're trying to bring a baby in the world. What are you thinking? Who are you thinking about? And somehow, right in the nick of time, I mean, really, if I messed that thing up, I was going to go to prison, right? And instead of sending me off to prison to go have a baby there, he lets me go back to Livermore and go live with the baby daddy guy, get an apartment. He gives me my son back 15 months early and says, go to probation and go to your meetings and behave yourself. And I was like, yes. So things are coming together, you know, and people warned me about being in relationships early. Bobby had 15 years of sobriety, and I had 45 days when I had gotten pregnant, sneaking around. And so there were some people with some strong opinions about, you know, what, that he was a predator and that I was a newcomer and that I shouldn't be in a relationship and things like that. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm never talking to you again. And I guess you're taking my inventory, so F you. And I didn't want anything to do with them. And ultimately I didn't want to be sponsored because of that either. Right. I knew that I was doing what I want and that I didn't want to be told what to do. But, you know, nonetheless, I have to go to these meetings. So I'm going down there. And I did have one sponsor for 1 hour. And she wanted me to tell the truth. And she made some predator remark. And so that was it. That was the end of our hour. So I went to the meetings. I was a cute little pregnant lady. But I never prayed at home. And I never worked a step. Everything on there about all those inventories or whatever, that was all about things that people in my family should have, and that would help her and her, and she should do that. I mean, I was like so not into recovery, and somehow I had strung together 18 months of service, but I was never, I mean, of sobriety or dry time, I guess, but I was never in service. I never prayed at home. I would not go to the potlucks. I wanted nothing to do with anybody. I was like, no, I'm not having it, and I'm not having some grown woman tell me what to do. So, nope, I didn't want sponsorship either. So, I started to hate Bobby big time. Things weren't working out. Baby wasn't even born yet. I was like, I hope you're not staying, and da-da-da-da-da. And what happened was I didn't have any tools, and I didn't have any friends, and I didn't have God in my life, and I didn't know how to stay in this relationship, and I didn't know, you know, anything. We get domestically violent, and all I knew was that I was as miserable as I was when I was out. And, well, things were on the surface were getting better because, you know, we have like this apartment and all these checklist items are happening, and, you know, the hair and makeup was looking good. I mean, surface wise, things were good, but inside I was miserable, and we're fighting and we're violent. And I was like, you know, I didn't get sober to be this miserable. I didn't. And I hate you, and everything's your fault. And, you know, I built my case and I drank with his name all over it. And I went out, and what happened was I lost, so I went out and I couldn't come back. I couldn't get sober for 4 years. And everything that, you know, they say like our relapses get worse and worse over time. And they do. Like I picked up where I was, but it just got so much worse, so much faster. And all of a sudden I lost both my children to CPS. And I couldn't believe what was happening. I mean, what happened? And I was like, well, people are butting in my life. Da 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 da. I'm a grown woman. And it was everything it was before, but it was 10 times worse. And, you know, incomprehensible demoralization was my name. It was so disgusting. It was so despicable. And I needed those kids taken away from me, but I wouldn't have told you that. I would have said, get the F out of my way, you know. And when I found out I was getting ready to go to, so I went to jail 6 times during that 4 years. I could not stay out of jail, and I couldn't keep my kids. I was constantly, when I did have them, I was putting them in harm's way constantly. And, it was just gross. And I couldn't stay sober. And I remember this lady asking me, what are you going to do when you get out? And I said, I'm going to get loaded. Duh. And, you know, and I would drink on the way home. And so I was getting ready to go to prison. I had 32 months in front of me. And I saw the a new judge. It was, I don't know where she came from. I already knew exactly in my head what was supposed to happen. I was supposed to go get sentenced that day. And so instead of like the same old guy and the same old routine, it was this new lady. And she said, "Ms. Mulligan, I'm going to give you the opportunity of a lifetime." And she didn't talk about sobriety. She didn't talk about rehab or any of the broken times. I didn't show up at the rehabs they said I could go to. She said, "I'm going to give you the opportunity of a lifetime to be the mother God wanted you to be." And for some strange reason, right there, I just, this tiny spot in my heart just started to thaw just a little bit. And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And, you know, it almost didn't happen. I did go to rehab. I did have a bad attitude. I had an affair there. I mean, all these things were happening again. It's like I wasn't getting it through my head, and nothing was my fault. And that one, I got in a fight, and that one, right, rehab too. I mean, I was bad attitude. And they would always have these ceremonies when girls would graduate, and we would all do a necklace, and everybody puts one bead on the string. And so what happened was, and you know, they pass the string around, right? So I put one for love, and the next girl puts a bead on for hope, and the next one for truth, and, you know, like all these things. And always somebody would be putting a bead on there for sponsorship. And I was like, ugh. Every time. And sometimes they would get like three beads for sponsorship. I was mad about that. Like, I just was like, how dumb. And I just thought it was so dumb. And service, I thought, was dumb too. Put beans on there for service. I just hated everybody that would say those things. And so I, what a surprise, I get kicked out of that place for having a bad attitude and stuff. And when I came back to Livermore, what happened was I schemed and I lied and I planned and I went to a few meetings, but I planned to get together with friends from that rehab that had also gotten kicked out because they cleaned house. And I thought about going by Crossroads and Hometown Fellowship to get somebody to come with me to save a girl who was in a hotel and drunk. She was drunk with $5,000 in this hotel, just needed a hero or something. And I was like, I should go by Crossroads and pick somebody up. And I was like, nah, I got this. And I hopped with 35 days sober. I hopped in a stolen car with no license and no money and went and broke all kinds of laws and to get the money to get up there to go save that girl. And what a surprise, I got drunk that night, right? Like, I knew all week long that was going to happen, but I told my mom I was going to go meet a sponsor, I'm going to go to the afternoon meeting, and all these lies. Like, I knew what was happening. So, and I got busted, and I was supposed to go to prison for real if I get caught. And for whatever reason, she didn't call my PO on me. And the next morning, I went to Crossroads, and I raised my hand. That was May 27, 2005. I do not know what in the world came over me. I have to say it was God or some type of higher power that I didn't understand at the time. But I do know that, you know, as much as they asked me to come to the potluck, and as much as I wanted to be like, "You know," I went and I brought something and I enjoyed myself and I started to be a little bit more open. I started to realize that maybe if I didn't take God up on this opportunity to go be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that that I was probably going to die. And I actually maybe was a little bit more afraid of going on the way that I was than I was of going along for this, like, happy, joyous, and free life. I was so, like, hardened that happy, joyous, and free, like, I was scared of it, you know? Like, then what? You take away my drugs, you take away my alcohol, you take away all the criminal stuff, you take away the lies. Like, what it was even going to be left? I was afraid there was, I wouldn't even be anything to me anymore if you take away those things. And I was scared of that. But I was less afraid than going on how I was. So I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and going for it. I prayed about it, which wasn't like a natural thing for me to do, but I just said, you know, like, God, if you're there, show me about this sponsorship thing, if this is supposed to happen. I literally prayed about a sponsor, and boom, there she comes, this perfect lady to be my sponsor. And I asked her, and she said yes. And what happened was, we opened that book and we got into it and we started reading it, and I started identifying, and there I was, right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We started saying the prayers, I started working the steps, I started complaining. She asked me one time, "Sheila, do we have to have the willingness talk?" I said, no, we don't. And And I started to put together some time, and I got on my knees and said prayers to her, and I did these horrendous homework assignments, and she wanted me to do things like call her at 3 o'clock exactly, not 3:05, but 3 o'clock, and I thought that was stupid, but I went along with it, and, I wasn't sure exactly how things were going to happen, but, you know, it was like, I got this idea in my head, like, what if there is something to the God thing? Like, I don't know, you know, did God abandon me? Did I abandon God? Who the heck was even God anyway? I was raised in a church, but, you know, I didn't know where I stood with that. And so this whole, like, God talk, it was kind of freaky, but it was really just that. It was like, well, what if it's true? What if the higher power thing works? And I think at that point, like, the door just opened just a little bit of a crack, and I didn't know what the result was going to be, but they said things like, you know, try it for a year, we'll refund your misery. They said things like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the last stop on the block. And I believed that. I mean, I kept, like, ending up here. And so, and then they said, work the steps or die. And so I did. I just got into it, and just started to look for the similarities. When they said look for the similarities, I did. And it was way better than looking at and staring at all the differences. And I started to really relate and identify. And I started to get really mad because I got sober and they said I could have my kids back when I got sober. And it wasn't happening fast enough. It wasn't happening in my time. And so I started to throw some tantrums and not get my way and still not get my way. And I got to say, one of the hardest things for me in early sobriety was learning, and even today sometimes, is learning to not get my way. Like, how do you even do that and not... You know, my MO was to get mad, throw a tantrum, huff out, slam the door, and go get drunk, and now it's your fault, right? I mean, that was kind of like a thing. And to get mad and deal with it and learn how to, you know, live life on life's terms, or how to be dealt a hand that wasn't good and not go drink over it, is a miracle all in itself. And they had said things like, you know, pray for people you're mad at or whatever, and I thought that was like a really stupid thing, but I was, you know, still coming and stuff, but I wasn't into that. And what happened was I got in this family fight about that, and I was with Bobby Jr. there, and he wasn't giving me the kid back, and I just it was my thing to fight with him. And instead of that, I said, you know what, I'm praying for you. And I don't even know where this came from, but this flashed in my head. I was like, that pray for other people thing, and I was like, I'm praying for you, you mother effer. I just said it with, like, all my insides. And and he was so used to me just, like, you know, starting to fight and stuff. He was like, huh? I was like, yeah, that's all. I'm just praying for you. That's it. He's like, okay. But what happened after that is things got soft, and there was a moment of relief, and I didn't go drink, and I didn't feel like I even needed to, and I was like, well, that's weird. And I remember they said, go pray for them for 2 weeks in a row, and I was like, yeah, I heard you guys, you said one day at a time, so that's what we're going to do on this. And I did, I prayed for them one day at a time, but it didn't last 2 weeks, because I wasn't even mad 2 weeks later. I had forgotten about it. And I learned how to work through some things. And I didn't get my kids back when I wanted, but I followed the direction of my sponsor. I did these homework assignments that I thought had nothing to do with it. I did my inventories. I did my amends. I did all the work that I was supposed to do, and it happened in God's time. And I got to learn how to be, you know, to sit and be okay with, you know, you're right where you're supposed to be, honey. Those things started to actually not be so bad to hear. And I was like, maybe I am, you know, and... The third step, too, was really awesome, because I started to learn that there was just so many things that I got to actually trust this higher power that I didn't understand. I got to trust him with that. And I didn't even know. I mean, I think in the beginning I called it like AA magic, because I would go to a meeting and like the coolest thing would happen when I would just be open-minded about it. And so, you know, in the beginning I called it AA magic, but today I just say God, because it's a lot easier. But, you know, we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, most of us pretty broken, and I did, and I had a lot of things to repair, and I had made a list early in sobriety of, you know, things I hoped to get out of sobriety, and had I stopped at that list, or had that been all there was, like, that's like this, and my life today is just exponentially bigger than I ever would have dared write some of these things on that list, You know, and I know it comes from being open-minded. I know it comes from doing the work. And there was stuff that I was going to take to my grave, and not so much secrets, but more like grudges. And I was never going to forgive people because, you know, don't you know, they ruined my life, and blah, 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 blah. But I learned that that those resentments should be between me and God, between me and you, and that they really blocked me off from a life of happiness. And so, you know, doing these inventories and going through four through nine, that personal house cleaning is so big. And I got to learn how much forgiveness actually helps. And there was people I was never going to forgive, but through all the process, I got to experience that, and I got to be open-minded about it, and to have the freedom from it. It's bigger. It's better than there's no way I can even put it into words, but it's such a spiritual freedom. And it's nothing I ever saw coming. I mean, I have this list of things I wanted, but nowhere on there was it that I would have a God of my personal God of my understanding. And that's like the best deal that I could have gotten out of sobriety. It's just such a trip. It's such a trip, and it's such a good trip. Dora, my first sponsor, she said, you know, say please in the morning, thank you at night, make sure you read at least a few pages of the Big Book every day, and that is how you're going to build your prayer and your meditation. And please is like, you know, keep me sober, right? And thank you is for having kept me sober, and all the stuff in between. And as I worked the steps, I got all the way. My prayers have changed too, but my prayers have changed. In the beginning, it was like, oh, keep me sober, help me, and spoil me, amen, right? Like, whatever it was, I need this job, I need this thing, I need, you know, just, I just wanted God to spoil me. And I think what happened was my higher power showed himself to me just enough so that I would keep coming back and keep asking. And so I would pray more, and my prayers were pretty self-centered, but I did my best. And when we got to 7 in the book, I started to learn to pray like for other people more than me, right? And I started to learn that when I do that, my own life is better than I could have asked anyway. I'm just not the focus of my prayer. And so that was a real big turning point too. And so every morning now I say the third step prayer, the 7th step prayer, and the 11th step faithfully. It's just so much better when I ask God, you know, who I can help, and that he get myself out of the way so that I can be useful to him or others. Being useful to him or others is such a key, and that's nothing I ever wanted to come and get out of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you'd have told me that I was going to come try to be useful to God and to others and maybe be responsible, pay my bills, I'd have ran like hell. You know what I mean? And don't forget, you're going to be truthful, you know. on paper those things didn't really look good, but they're just so freeing. It is the easier, softer way, and I'm just so glad I've joined. So, and decided to give Alcoholics Anonymous a good try, you know, just to try it with all my heart, and it's just been so good. The fellowship is so good. I wrote in my book, Working with Others, we read it tonight, I had written sponsorship, my goal, and I didn't know if it was ever going to, you know, start or get one or whatever, but I did, and I started working with these girls, and I get them, step one, they'd go. I don't know where they went, but they wouldn't stay with me. I took, like, for a whole year, I couldn't get a girl off of step one, and then finally I got a girl up to step two, and then, you know, but what happened, I don't know what happened to some of these girls. Some I've never seen again. Some of them stayed around and got other sponsors, but what happened is I got to stay sober, and I got to gain a better understanding of the Big Book in the process, and I think the best thing that could happen as we learn the steps and everything is to be giving it away. I don't coddle my sponsees, and when they get up to 12, we don't start over and just all about her all the time. She wants to get more into it, she go get a sponsee, and then we work stuff on demand. That's what my sponsor, if we need to do an isolation, let's do a 4-step on that. Work's troublesome, you know, let's get into it. We can work the steps on demand. We work a whole bunch of steps all the time in everyday life. So, you know, I don't need to sit down and focus on one girl all the time, you know. Keep doing it. Just go get a sponsee. And that's when we really start growing. That's been my experience. That's been the experience of the women that I sponsor. And we have some pretty good full lives because of it. I do a lot of service. I always have. There's been a few rough patches in Alcoholics Anonymous where it kind of felt like the wheels are falling off the wagon. And I will say, when I looked around, I was like, oh, well, I
We'll cheat it out of that, and that one's over, and, oh, I'm not even doing any service right now. It's like ding, ding, ding. So I go get a service commitment, and boom, my life starts getting better again. And it doesn't make sense. It's like, well, I'm so busy, right? Like, how does that fit in? How am I going to get my meetings in? But, you know, when I make room for my program, when I make room for service, when I put God and Alcoholics Anonymous first, the rest of my life works out way better than if I start to checklist my own life and squeeze Alcoholics Anonymous on the side, right? I mean, it just works out. I put it first. He takes care of me, and that's been the case. I'm trying to think of what else I could just finish with. I mean, I'm in a home group. I'm in service. The traditions, I kind of heard them for a long time, and it turns out we work the traditions way before we even know it. And thank God for the traditions and people not, you know, kicking me out for acting like an idiot in my first... was in the fellowship. I was a maniac. And, you know, thank God for the traditions that keep Alcoholics Anonymous here. When Bill Wilson wrote them, he originally named them the 12 points to assure our future, and it's so that the fellowship could stay here over time. And it's not just, you know, the steps that are saving me, but it's the traditions too. I had this, my second sponsor, Sandra, used to ask me, because I'd have, like, problems, whatever, you know, you call your sponsor about your stuff, right? And she'd say, well, what spiritual principle is going to help you, Sheila, or solve your problem today? And I would have to look at the spiritual principle to figure out what was going to help. And that was from the steps. And it turns out there's, you know, spiritual principles in the traditions and in the concepts, and they work at work, and they work at home, and they work in all kinds of places. So, you know, it's part of the design for living, and it does. It comes out of the book, it comes out of the fellowship, and it comes from a God that I happen to find here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, for that, I'm very grateful, and I thank you all for inviting me to the meeting tonight, for 12-stepping me, and for showing up. So, thank you so much.